How are you, Jeff?
I'm good, bro. How are you? Well, very better
good,
than you,
very
maybe.
good. Yeah, sorry to pulled a left a fast one last second because I'm sick. So we are still kind of under COVID, so better be safe than sorry. You know what I mean by
Yep, I appreciate that. I hope you feel
that?
better soon.
Thank you, thank you. So happy Monday. Actually, it is not Monday
No,
today.
it's because of the long weekend. We delayed it.
And there is another reason why we wanted to shoot it today. Do you know what day today is?
Well, happy 1 year anniversary to my business partner in this podcast.
I
We
know.
did it.
We did it. Today is the 1 year anniversary for the Micro Vancouver Real Estate. It is not going to be a hard one to remember because it's literally the day after one of our good buddies' wedding.
Yep.
So every time they see happy anniversary posts, we know exactly, tomorrow is going to be the anniversary. As a recap, in the last 52 weeks, we did, well, today is our 34th episode. So good stuff. Good stuff. We all know that starting a podcast wasn't easy. We all started because we just wanted to share some value. And I will say after 33 episodes, we have gone through so many topics. So before we start today's, I guess, news roundup, let's just quickly review our year here. Maybe I'll ask you, what is the best lesson you learned from the podcast in the last 12 months?
I think that's a very good question. And with some self-reflection, being a relatively newer agent, like under 5 years, I think over the last year, we've had so many policy changes in the industry, and the podcast has been such a great tool for me to learn and to stay up to date with the most recent news. Some things that stood out to me are definitely the foreign buyer ban, the home buyer rescission period, and anti-flipping. And I would say another big takeaway for me would be seeing the market from a bigger picture, not just from residential houses, townhouses, and condos, but how like global and federal policies affect all the different industries that are tied to real estate, like, in terms of construction, development, and things like that. But we'll talk a little bit more about that later. What about you?
Well, aside from the policies, because we did have a lot of policy changes. I think one thing that people tend to forget for realtors is that we are always on the go. We're going here, we're going there. And one of the things I agree with you is that if we weren't doing these podcasts, we won't be so in tune with all these policy changes, market updates, what's happening with the market. I'll give you a perfect example. Back then, when I wasn't doing the podcast, I would read everything through, but then that's the last time I'll ever touch it, unless I need to pull it out because I need to talk to clients and stuff like that. But whereas the podcast, ever since we started doing it, it really makes you focus on trying to understand what's the meaning behind everything that we're being posting out there and what are the policy changes, because it does force us to really think about it, because that's actually how you create content, right? Because, with the podcast, we are content creators. And in order for us to talk about content, content that people care about, we can't just be reading directly right off the news article.
Yeah, and as if as realtors we weren't wearing enough hats already. Now we're also content creators, we are creatives, we are what, IT people, we're doing videography, like wow. But it's a lot of fun. It was a great learning experience for sure.
Of course. And I will say that very, very soon we're probably gonna have to start dancing in front of our cameras like a bunch of TikTokers.
No, thank you. That's all you, man.
I love how you're like, yeah, no, I'm not gonna respond to that. Second question, 33 episodes in, which one is your favorite episode?
This is really hard. I was actually looking at all of them, and I feel like throughout every single episode, there has been different takeaways and different things that I feel like were of a lot of value. I would have to say maybe the wood frame versus concrete, or high rise versus low rise, because I really liked being able to have more of a dialogue between you and I, as opposed to like us just reporting on something. I feel like that was a little bit more of the style that appealed to me, and also being able to learn of all the differences between wood frame and concrete. I had my own stigmas and misconceptions, and after that, I feel like my opinion was slightly changed. And even I was able to share that value to a lot of our clients And I think that's why it really stood out to me, like those two episodes.
Oh, okay. Those are good. Those are good. So you do like the debate stuff. We should go back to debating a little bit more.
I think so. I mean, it's a little bit engaging. And at the end of the day, like, we write episodes based off of feedback from our listeners. So that's, I feel like, a couple episodes where we got the most traction too.
Yeah, fair enough. Maybe something for us to think about as we enter into the second year of the podcast.
Mm-hmm. What about you? What's your favorite episode?
I have two answers for this. My first answer is, and some of them might feel really gimmicky, is the first episode. Really, honestly, I still remember the day that we went to the lab 1.0. And then we're trying to set things up. Camera wasn't working. The memory wasn't working. We didn't plug the mic in properly. I was still trying to recover from the wedding the day before.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. And honestly, because this is something new, I don't think I ever shared with you. Even though I was trying to keep everything together, I was super nervous. Like, my stomach was actually hurting. Like, I knew that we're going to be posting this. I'm always the kind of person that I don't want to say the wrong things, especially if this is going to be on the internet forever. So that's why I always remember the first episode. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's one of the learning lessons as we did more and more podcasts, is like, of course, we always try to get the correct information, but obviously we're not perfect. The second one I really like was actually the interview with Ashley. You remember Ashley? It's been a little while. I feel like sometimes, yes, we are business partners. We are, we talk to each other a lot, and maybe because of that, this interaction, like, I can, it's almost, a lot of listeners doesn't know, but like, it's somewhat predictable. I kind of know exactly what your thinking process is. With Ashley being able to come in and beat that third, I learned tons with Ashley. Remember Ashley, the Toronto market, some of the craziest things that happened. Like, it was just a lot of fun. It was very educational, and I guess it teaches me a lot of stuff that I didn't know about. Like, Toronto is a completely different world. So I definitely want to continue doing more of these interview podcasts. It's just been a little bit harder to arrange things, but that's something that is definitely something that we want to continue working on. And being able to talk to other professionals, then obviously we will get different mindsets, different perspective on things that maybe is just outside of just me and you.
I love that. And, you know, with the podcast growing, like, not only are listeners learning and growing, but, you know, as are you and I every single time we film an episode. And I really enjoy the process, and I'm hoping that we can do this for years and years to come. I think it's a lot of fun. And you know what? Don't be so hard on yourself, because with how cancel culture is nowadays, I think everyone, when they're speaking in public places, is a little bit cautious of what they're saying and what, like, the internet's reaction is going to be.
Exactly. And then I also learned that maybe because we're a little small and we're not, you know, we don't have thousands of followers, I realized that some of the things that even I do a little bit of mistakes, like, you know, it's okay. Like, people tend to don't not care too much about it yet. And that means that whatever I did screw up, it wasn't too much. Right. But we always try to tell people if we see something wrong, we always try to tell people afterwards. Mm-hmm. I guess my last question before we start moving on to the news roundup is, I don't think I ever asked you, and that's kind of my fault, is, like you said, you're a newer agent. There's a lot in real estate. And I know you could probably do a whole episode on yourself talking about all the stuff that you've been trying to learn in the last 12 months or 24 months. Is there any episode that, or any topic that you always wanted us to talk about, and you think that would be very beneficial to the listeners, but we haven't really touched base on that just yet? I'm just curious.
I feel like most of the time when you and I discuss, like, episodes, we do have a lot of dialogue about, like, well, what do we think is interesting? So I feel like up until now, everything that I've been curious about, we have discussed. And sometimes, like, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that goes for the listeners too. Maybe one topic I feel like would be kind of interesting is talking a little bit more about the negotiation process, like, strategies, because I think that's, like, being able to take a look under the hood from a listener's perspective of more about, like, the day-to-day of what realtors are responsible for, because I feel like a lot of it sometimes is unknown. I think the majority of the people out there still think that, like, oh yeah, these people, they dress in a suit or not, and they go and open the door, and oh, they make a big fat check after selling a place, and it's so easy. So
it's funny you brought that up. Sorry to cut you off. I was actually having a conversation with a really close friend. Like, we've been friends for 20 plus years. Mm-hmm. And he accidentally, I'm not going to say who, but he accidentally said, "Man, you realtors, your money comes so easy." And I was just like, how can you say something like that, especially when I already tell you, like, the sleepless nights, like, you know, my weight literally, like, I'm ballooning as a weight because, like, when stress comes, like, I just lose weight super quickly. Like, I was like, you see me go through all of this. How can you say something like that? And I realized that, you know, they only see the pretty side of things, you know, just like our social media. They see the listed, they see the sold, they see this, but they don't see the ones that's like midnight and I'm talking to my clients and I'm about to cry because, like, there are things like we just can't control, and then I'm trying to hold everything in place. And I always say, like, yeah, we're realtors, but if you learn a little bit more about our industry, I feel sometimes like we're more like firefighters. My girlfriend Rita doesn't quite understand what that means, but I always tell her that we're just literally going to point A, you know, save this fire, and then, oh my god, I quickly go to point B and save that fire. And at the same time, we're also trying to find new clients and try to even have a house to be building, like, you know, in the first place, to have problems, right? So it's like we always say, it is a, we are men of many, many masks, and whatever people see on social media is truly kind of the most glamorous part of things. There's a lot of things about this industry that is not glamorous.
You mean your phone isn't constantly ringing off the hook of people wanting to buy and sell with you?
Oh, I mean, yes. Do you? But you say that, it also means that every time that phone call comes, I turn around and look at my girlfriend, and she's looking at me like, seriously? Seriously? It's like 11 p.m.
I hope we can, like, rewind in this episode a clip of you talking about that New Year's and how it went down with you and Rita out in New York and you still negotiating an offer. We are on the clock 24/7. A lot of people are. You know, some people, they choose not to work after a certain time, but you know what? That's not you. And I think your clients definitely appreciate the work that you put into it. So give yourself some credit.
I was about to say, it's like, what? You don't sit in the middle of 6th Ave in New York City while cars, people are walking by, and you're literally on your freaking laptop in front of freaking the library, the most famous library in the world, literally trying to write an offer? What? People don't appreciate that? Or the fact that it was New Year's Eve and it literally was 11:59:23, so there was about 40 seconds left till the new year, and I was literally on the phone with my client talking about offer for a UBC place. People don't appreciate that stuff.
Nope. Right? You should.
Nope.
But, you know, let's not go off track too much here. I think you and I have had an amazing year with the podcast, and, you know, we really want to throw it back to you guys, the listeners, too, just to appreciate you, because at the end of the day, we're doing this because of you, and we wouldn't be here doing this otherwise.
Exactly.
So,
exactly. Thank you. We will do something special, but I don't want to get Jeff sick. So we'll do something special the next time we get together. So, but without further ado, so much for the recap. Let's get into the real stuff, which is the news roundup for the month of July. We have a lot of really serious things to talk about here, but why don't you start first? And then we'll just alternate. You go first, I go second, and then you catch up, and then, you know, I go after that.
Okay. I think we wanted to talk about, oh, one bedroom rent in Vancouver.
Oh, no, that's me. Sorry. I'll start first. I'll talk about that, and then you'll go, and then I'll go, and you'll go. Sorry about that. Okay, first article right here. Average one bedroom rent in Vancouver spikes to unthinkable levels. Unthinkable is right. Based on rental.ca, our average one bedroom rent in Vancouver is now $2,945 monthly. That's a 4% increase month to month, and it's a 18.1% year to year. Two bedrooms is now at $3,863. That's a 5.4% increase month to month, and a 14.2% increase year to year. After Vancouver, Burnaby is solidly in second place with one bedroom at 25.78, which is a 27.2% spike year over a year. You see, I can't even say it with, like, you know,
are we in Alberta? Face.
Like, this is absolutely insane. I knew that the rent went up a lot, but 27.2% year to year, that, ugh. And before we start throwing more of my thought, the article ends that out of all the major cities, Edmonton is the most affordable. I think one bedroom is renting for $1,100.
Nice.
Which is kind of the one bedroom that I was renting in Vancouver in 2008.
2008 sounds like a lifetime ago. I mean, I feel like my initial thoughts are, it seems like, I want to know how many renters, like, what, where do they get this data from? Because that sounds even crazier than us when we do market update. Like, that's way above. $2,900 for a one-bedroom apartment in Vancouver? Like, we were talking about West Van. That was like 2 months ago that had maybe a couple cases of that.
Yeah, I mean, and another thing I was going to say is, like, you know, 4% increase month to month. Can you imagine if our real estate market goes up 4% month after month? Like, I think even with some of the hottest market out there, like, we were touching 4%, but, like, that was when the market was absolutely going crazy.
Well, like, I think average, the HPI price would be going up like 50K a month or 60K a month.
The graph will literally look like this, like straight up, right?
But I mean, that means more inventory will come onto the market,
right? We'll see. We'll see on that, all right? I mean, aside from that, I mean, how do we get here? I mean, do we really need to go back? Let's just quickly talk about it. I mean, the lack of supply, the lack of getting things approved to build, creating a environment where the developer really will actually want to build. And then on top of that, the supercharged immigration program that they did starting last year. I mean, that pretty much summarizes it for what's happening with the rental market, which is crazy if you still don't think that this is a supply and demand issue. If you truly still believe that, at least this is my opinion, that any policy changes can stop any of this, they're dreaming, I guess I'll put it that way, because this is probably the most solid number that we can give to people. It's like, dude, we have all these people coming and we don't have enough homes for people, and people are getting desperate, hence the 27.2% spike year after year.
I agree. I don't know what other evidence they need. Like, this is literally in our face.
Yeah, like, it's right in there, right? Now, on the flip side, I would say that focusing on the real estate side, if you are an investor with real cash, this might be a huge opportunity. Now, granted, July, August is generally kind of like the peak moving season of the year. So that's generally where you would expect the biggest spike. But like I said, once again, 14% for two bedrooms, 18% for one bedroom year after year. That is still crazy. Now, let me just put this number in comparison to some US states. So let's just use the number $2,945 a month. It's about $2,200 a month in US dollars. Mm-hmm. That would put us right around the same rent as Santa Ana, California, and Oakland, California. Santa Ana is at $2,100 a month, average one bedroom, and Oakland is at $2,190, which is $2,200. Now, I went a little deeper and I tried to break this down in terms of really like affordability, like how are people doing this? Here's the funny thing. In Oakland, California, the household income on average is $80,143 USD. Mm-hmm. Santa Ana has a household income of about $72,406. So don't get me wrong, these rentals with these kind of household income, difficult. But compared to Vancouver, we are even worse. Based on CMHC, we as Canadians have a household income about $96,423, which if you calculate it back down to US dollars, that's about $71,815.85 per year. Mm-hmm. After taxes, that will give us $63,361. So
that makes no sense.
We make a lot less money than people in the States, and we are paying a lot more rent. So like you said, none of this will make any sense. Now, you, I know, have been always very adamant about, you know, helping the renters and stuff like that. What is your advice for renters or potential going to be renters right now in this state?
I think, first of all, I would say, I'm sorry that we are in a situation like this. It's not our fault. It's not the renter's fault that this is going on. And I just want to make sure people are pointing the fingers at the right people.
It's not the landlord either.
No, and it's definitely not the landlord. And we have talked about that. Landlords also people. They're trying to do business and they're really not making as much money as people might think that they are. I would really ask ourselves the question of how much do you want to be in Vancouver and why? And based off of your answer, everyone's going to have a different answer. You may or may not want to stay in Vancouver. You might want to go. But I think the things that our parents' generation tried to really teach us and instill in us about, you know, living beneath your means, like that's very, very important. Maybe you don't need to buy a Mercedes or, you know, luxury car and show off to your friends or whatever, you know, because a car is just going to get you from point A to point B. Maybe be open to other areas. Maybe Surrey ain't looking so bad if it's a little bit more affordable out there and you're able to make it work with like your work and working remotely. Get a roommate or three.
And or just five.
Or five. And honestly, just hang in there because the majority of the people in Vancouver, they're experiencing the same thing. The people in the rental market, yes, there's a pool of them that make six-figure salaries and they're still renting. But there's also a lot of people who are making minimum wage and there's no way that they can survive. There's like another article out there that in order for it to be more affordable, and affordability means you're spending 30% of your income, no more than that, on rent or housing, we need to be making $32 an hour. I think that's double what the minimum wage is right now. And we're just giving you that statistic so that you don't feel like you're going crazy because you're not. It's the system that's not working. Yeah.
And at this point right now, I'm just going to slide this in. I'm not going to make a super clear cut where I lean, but ever since they talk about increasing minimum wage, it just costs a lot more to live within the city. That's all I'm saying. Right.
Okay. And I think that's enough said. You know, the last thing I do want to touch on, like the immigration, is that, hey, yes, we're importing a lot of immigrants because we need a labor force, skilled laborers, and people doing entry level jobs. But I think it just went too crazy.
I agree. A lot of people were like, I was reading an article, people were like, you know, stop the immigration. I was like, no. We are Canada. We can't just be like, no immigration for the next 3 years. But like, these are some of the things that people are saying. Like, no immigration until supply with homes, like there's a certain ratio that's been met. We can't do that because, like you said, we do that, we're no better than Japan, where it's an aging population and we're just, everything's just going to go down. It's going to be a completely different social issue altogether. But we also need to consider how many people we try to bring in, right? I'm not saying that the current number is bad. If we are going to try to bring in this current number, do we have a plan behind it? If it's going to take you a couple of years to create this plan, then maybe we should slowly escalate to that level and not just go from here and then next time we're already here. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, I'm going to interject right there. You say it's a couple years plan. They should have at least spent 5 to 10 years doing projections and planning this out, because it's not just like housing, it's like the infrastructure, like electrical grids, like so many things. Like, can we handle it? I don't know if we can handle it.
Let me just put it this way. My mom is here in Vancouver with me. We don't, you know, because the last several years is because of COVID. Just to add on to your point, just one thing. Doctor, medical. I didn't even know this because I guess I'm fortunate enough. I always had a family doctor. Mm-hmm. Even though after you retire, I was able to use my connections and quickly find another family doctor. But I was told that a lot of these new immigrants, it's almost impossible for them to find a family doctor. And they're now saying that Canada is a place where you better not get sick, because the moment you get sick, you're just going to be waiting. It's like, it's kind of like the States, but for a completely different reason. People say in the States, you can't get sick because you're going to go bankrupt. Here, it's like, you can't get sick because nobody's going to help you. You're going to probably die. So that is what I agree with you. That's the thing I was trying to say, is with all these population coming in, do we have the infrastructure? Do we have the systems? Do we have the professionals in order to support all of this? And I'm not in the medical industry, but I do know that with a lot of these new immigrants coming in, they can't just immediately become a doctor. Like, it's a huge hurdle for them to go across. And that is a complete, once again, a completely different issue altogether. So
I'm surprised you're worried about that, because I thought you would just go to Dr. ChatGPT and do a diagnosis there.
I mean, yeah, that's what I do, but I also know that I trust AI a lot more than 99% of the people out there. Anything else for this before we move on to what you want to talk about the most today?
No, I don't think so. I think to summarize, okay, we've been talking about how crazy rent is for the last 12 months. Well, basically since last July, it's when the rental market was going crazy. And thank you very much for doing that breakdown of comparing it to our neighbors down south. It definitely paints a clearer picture for us. But no, I think that was a great article to share. The next one I have here is City of Vancouver to delay developer fee hikes due to economic conditions. This actually made me very, very happy, because I feel like over the last couple months, you and I have talked about this, is that, hey, with the inventory shortage, we need to give more incentives to people and for them to build. No, we're not saying, hey, the big developers are, you know, the rich get richer, like that kind of situation. That's not what we're saying. But there is a desperate need for housing. And the only way is to get people to build. So how are you going to get people to build? You have to give them some type of incentive. Now, you and I often talk about CACs, community amenity contributions. And for those of you who don't know, they apply to rezoning projects only. And what it is that the developer, they have to pay a contribution in order to build spaces like new libraries, community centers, daycares, park improvements, or they can also be making payments in lieu. So instead of building these, they're just forking out the cash to do that. The interesting thing to me is that the amount of the CAC, they can be negotiated or be based on annual CAC funding targets. So the amount can vary. My initial feelings towards that is like, okay, that's a little bit sketchy. And I don't know exactly how to make it fair. What this article is talking about is actually regarding DCLs, development cost levies. So not only do developers have to pay towards the community amenity contributions, but they also have to pay a set amount of money that's used to partially fund parks, childcare facilities, and engineering structures. The biggest difference, I think, between CACs and DCLs is that DCLs are calculated on a per square footage basis. And originally, what the government wanted to do is that they wanted to raise the DCL by, I think, 12.5% for this year. But after they were calculating with inflation and everything, it actually ended up being a 20 to 30% increase. And to put that into perspective as a reference, now, a developer pays around $125,000 per unit or $157 per square foot towards the CAC and DCLs. That's nearly $15,000 more than Markham in Ontario. That's nuts. So when you're buying that $750,000 condo, why is it $750,000? Well, now you know. It is interesting to note, though, you know, like Burnaby does charge much lower, with an average of $19,000 or $24 per square foot. That was like a statistic that I was like, dang, no wonder Burnaby has been up and coming for the last 5-10 years, because it's just been cheaper for developers to build, and they're still able to appreciate the lift in the market, and it all makes a lot of sense.
And on top of that, I'll just add, before you move on to the next part, is that because obviously my background pre-sales is that not only is the city of Burnaby cheaper in terms of these fees, levies, and stuff like that, the system is also more standardized. It's not like, oh, depending on what you want to do, we're going to charge you differently, or depending who you talk to, we're going to charge you. No, it's not like that. Apparently, city of Burnaby is just very straightforward. Get it done. this is how much it's going to cost. And that's why, to add on to your point, Burnaby has been the talk of town for the last 10 years. Sorry to
cut you off there. No, that's totally fine. And you know what? So these developers get slapped with a double whammy. They're paying a CAC and they're paying a DCL. Like, it is a little bit tough, especially when the amounts are sometimes are a little bit ambiguous and can be negotiated. Whereas, like, it's a lot more fair how the city of Burnaby operates. Now, you and I talk a lot about inventory shortage. Well, we talk about how construction costs have also gone up 51%. Many people don't know that developers also have to pay the CAC and the DCL. So when you put it into perspective of how much it actually costs to build, I think we're able to show a little bit more empathy towards developers in that it's not just like, hey, they bought a piece of land, they held it, they make a bunch of money, and it's the end user that is missing out because we're paying inflated prices. No, we are all in this together, both the developer and the consumer. We are at the mercy of the governing body. So I just want to make sure that we are pointing the finger at the right place when we talk about unaffordability and how we can make a big impact on making things more affordable is maybe charge them a little bit less. So when this article came out and I saw that, hey, they were getting a bit of a break and they weren't going to do such a steep increase, it made me relax a little bit, because the biggest issue I feel like is that with the rising costs in developing, developers just aren't building. Like, you'll touch on that a little bit later, but really it's the little guys that are hurting. It's the, you know, smaller projects that are 50 units. Imagine how those people are managing. They don't have as deep pockets as like the really big developers out there. I won't name them, but they're just people too. And they're trying to, you know, put food on the table for their families. Like, we are all in the same boat and we have all the same goals. I also want to add here that, you know, the Canadian Home Builders Association reported that the city of Vancouver has the steepest municipal fees for new high-rise residential buildings in the country. So another testament as to why Vancouver has such crazy real estate prices. They're making a lot of money when a project goes up. How we're allocating that money? Well, they are doing a lot of like really good things, like improving park spaces, and who knows how exactly every single dollar is allocated. But the government is still the people that are in control. So,
of course. Of course. And with all that being said, we're going to get canceled very soon, aren't we?
Just kidding. I think we're being a little bit vague. We say the government. We never say like which governing body, you know, but.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think you covered this whole thing very, very, very well. I'll just add a couple of notes. If you're wondering how come the development for downtown Vancouver really stopped, you know, I think it was about 10, 15 years ago, there was a lot of new projects coming in downtown Vancouver. But if you really think about it, in the last 4 years, how many projects has actually come out in downtown? Really, honestly, right? It's almost, I can't, maybe one, two, 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 15, 15, 18, 18.
Yeah.
I can't even think about anything else, right? And a lot of people say, oh, why downtown not building? This is a world-class city and stuff like that. Well, this is the reason why, right? Because the number doesn't make sense. I talk to developers, big developers, small developers. I think I'll just emphasize on this. For mid to small-sized developers in the Vancouver West Side, if they recently just bought their land, recently, I'm talking about recently, probably like the last 3 years, I was told that if they don't sell for $2,000 per square foot, they're straight up just losing money because of the fees, the cost, the materials, and stuff like that. So what am I trying to say is, I agree with you, the days where the developers are getting 30 to 40% profit margin, those are basically old news. They're really outdated. Developers now are generally relatively happy to be in the teens of profit margin. And a lot of people are still like, in the teens, that's still a lot. But people tend to forget how much risk a developer is holding when they're building a residential high-rise like this, because so many things could go wrong that would, oh, they don't lose $10,000 or $20,000 like that. If they take a misstep, they lose hundreds. I have heard stories they lose millions of dollars. Right? So we always say, in terms of investing, the ones that comes with a higher risk should have the highest payout. But because of all the things, all of this that's happening, developers, they're not getting the best payout anymore, and they're still holding on to quite a bit of risk.
Yes. And lastly, I think I just want to remind the listeners that like we've seen two relatively big developers announce bankruptcy in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
What more do you think, like how many more cases of this do you think we're going to see if they keep making it harder and harder for developers to build? I mean, I wouldn't get excited to wake up in the morning and know that I'm going to buy this piece of land, is going to cost me 100 mil to develop. And out of that 30%, I have to give to the government.
Yeah, no. And I put it right here. Let me just put everything into perspective. You know, if we are able to reduce the amount or completely just scrap it out, imagine this. Right now, downtown is starting the lowest price, $1,800 a square foot. Richmond is starting about $1,100 a square foot. Burnaby is about starting at about $1,200 a square foot. Surrey is about $1,000 a square foot. If we could immediately just reduce all of that number by 157, still expensive, but don't get me wrong, it's a lot more affordable, a lot more affordable. And that's one thing that I always say, the government can't do too much in regards, because there is we're in a capitalist, you know, society, right? So we have free market, but this is definitely one thing that they could help the general public in order to kind of lower, you know, lower the real estate prices just by that alone, I would say. And another thing I would say is that if they just lower that, more developers will see that there's going to be a little bit less risk. So they would promote more buildings. Like they'll be more actively trying to, because there's less risk. So this is a win-win situation if they're able to do that. Because as we're going to be talking about the next article, everything kind of just links together, because if this continues, then we're going to get into a serious trouble kind of a couple years down the road. But before we do that, though, before we do move on to the next topic, anything you want to talk about here? Like you want to wrap it up nicely, or you're good?
I think to summarize this and wrap this up is that I'm very happy that the developers are getting a little bit of a break from all the money they have to pay the local government in order to develop. And hopefully with this break that they're receiving, it'll bring more developers back into the game, onto the table, and it'll help with our inventory issue a little bit more, because I know you're going to be touching on it right after as to what kind of sticky situation we're potentially getting into for the next couple of years.
And that's where all the good news stops. And I am here to be the bearer of the bad news. No, I'm just joking.
Mr. Doom and Gloom is back.
I am back. Okay, next, since you already kind of pre-warned people, there's going to be a little bit more reading on this. There's a lot more numbers I want people to understand. So I'll go through the numbers. I'll go through kind of the article, and then we'll just start sharing what we think. So BC Real Estate Investments pummels in the first half by Evison Young. Industrials comes on top of total investment dropped by 72%. Sales of all asset classes, including multifamily and land, fell 72% to $2.4 billion in the first half of 2023 versus 8.7 billion a year earlier. Mm-hmm. Private investors were the primary buyers in the last 6 months. So once again, private investors accounting for 85% of the purchases of offices, retails, industrial properties. Similarly, private vendors represent 98% of all sellers across all asset classes. Mm-hmm. So a lot of private people doing private deals. We have observed private capitals taking the lead in investments, while institutional investors has been cautious with portfolios rebalancing and cash preservations, said Jessica, a principal and managing director with Evison Young in Vancouver. However, the industrial sector has displayed resilience, and we anticipate institution investors gradually re-entering the market as interest rate certainty improves. The last 60 days has seen a return of the investors with greater certainties about the downward directions of inflation, aiding investment appetites. Mm-hmm. several quietly marketed investment opportunities has come to the market in the previous 90 days, which suggests that there will be a strong investment activities for the rest of 2023. So that's the good news. Mm-hmm. While industrial transactions were driven by renewed confidence from institutional investors as interest rates show signs of stabilizing, the impact of financing costs on developments puts the brake on both residential and ICI land purchases. Some proposed residential developments prior to the interest rate hikes were no longer deemed financially viable. That's a key thing. With few profitable developments opportunity, prospective buyers have been preserving cash and are more selective on when and where to deploy their capital. Well, capitalized developers has been taking advantage of the current lending environment to pursue projects, but overall investment in the residential land fell 80% in the first half of 2023 versus a year earlier. This drove an 87% decline in the overall valuation of land transactions as investors stuck to the sidelines. And here's the most important thing. Stricter financing terms and rising construction-related costs have impacted developments in British Columbia, leading to reduced development appetite and lower yields for developers. Okay, that is a mouthful. But, I mean, she's pretty much talking about everything that we previously talked about already, right? Yes. Let's just quickly talk about the instability of the interest rate in the last 12 months. We always talk about how residential is going to get funneled down, mm-hmm. and but the needs are still there because of immigration. However, the impact of rising interest rate for commercial real estate cannot be ignored. And that's one thing that we have not touched base on this podcast whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Okay? Before I continue, what was the last thing you heard about commercial real estate?
What was the last thing?
Yeah.
In this article?
Not in article. Like, have you spoken with anyone in regards to commercial real estate? How is it doing? How has it been? How has those realtors been? Have you talked to any of them?
Oh, I think a lot of them have a lot of free time right now. That's why they're going on vacations, meaning... It doesn't sound like, at least from the people I've been talking to, that there's been that much going on with commercial. And I think this article does a very good job summarizing it. The rise in interest rates, the statistics are there. The transactions are at an all-time low. People are very cautious about how they're spending their money. And most people, the ones that are holding on to land, they're just holding on to it. And they're hoping that they have some cash flow positive generating property. But not all of them are getting it, especially when we talk about how commercial leases are like, there's so many available because people aren't taking commercial leases anymore. It's just like a bit of a clusterfuck.
Yeah, no. And for a listener that doesn't know, I do have a commercial wing, Stephen and Matthew. I talked to them here and there, and they have been telling me that this year has been extra tough. Like, I follow these guys when they're go-getters. I mean, they're still go-getters. They work hard and everything like that. Last couple of years, they had great years. They're killing it. They're doing great. But I just went to dinner with one of them, and they're literally telling me, yo, like, I don't know how long I can keep doing this, right? They're literally telling me that it feels like commercial real estate is literally going through like a complete overhaul of how people think, how people live, and just over what people think about this. So to continue what you're saying is that, you know, we talked about, you know, work from home impacting office vacancies. Now, we talked about that one before. Right now, downtown Vancouver is sitting at about 11%, and that's already not too bad in North American standard. As a reminder, I think Calgary is like over 43% or something like that of full office vacancies. And I guess with the interest rate hike seems to be coming to an end, fingers crossed, the confidence, the willingness to go back to commercial real estate is starting to increase. And that has been, I guess, reconfirmed by Stephen and Matthew, my commercial wings, that they're saying that they are starting to get a little busier. But then again, they're saying that anything would have been busier. That's how bad it actually got at one point.
Yeah.
However, the key point I want to get out of this article is actually the end portion of it. The earlier portion, we get it. Industrial is doing much better because people shop on Amazon now. Offices are hurting. Retails, you're kind of just like struggling along. But the bigger problem from the article looms from all that interest rate hike, which is land purchases, especially for residential purposes. I mean, they talk about it in the literally the last two sentences of that article. Understand, even though the article says investor are also include potential developers and builders, our land transaction has reduced by 87%. And Jeff, if our land transaction reduced by 87%, what do you think is going to happen to developments?
I mean, that's a little brain teaser there. That's a skill test question. Well, let's see. If people are not buying land, they're definitely not building on any land. So yeah. It sounds like we're back to an inventory issue, and this one is going to last a lot longer than people might think.
Correct. So what I think this means is that we might see a lot less projects, like, you know, those pre-sale projects that everybody likes to go and visit and buy in the next couple of years. And this is going to be extremely, extremely obvious for small to mid-sized developers. Mm-hmm. Bigger developers who have those land sitting there for 30 years, 40 years, or 10, even 10 years, they can still go ahead. The profit margin is still there because they bought the land so cheap. But for these mid to small-sized developers, I don't think any of them is going to try to develop anything anytime soon, unless this interest rate thing is under control. I mean, you work with some builders. I work with some small time builders. They, you know, they build duplexes and stuff like that. And we have heard over and over again, they can't make the numbers work. And if they can't make the numbers work, why are they doing this, right? That's why we have a huge, huge ass swimming pool in the middle of Richmond Center. I mean, by Lansdowne, because if they build it, they'll lose even more money. And that's exactly what I think is going to happen. And because there's only so many big developers out there that has been sitting on these land for a long period of time. So it's going to get to a point exactly like you said. We have no small builders. We have no mid-sized builders. We have no builders that bought recently. That in the next couple of years, we're just not going to have that many projects, which ultimately in the next 4 to 5 years, we don't have any that many new homes coming out. Mm-hmm. And then what that really means is prices are going to continue to go up because immigration isn't stopping whatsoever, right? So that's basically what this whole article says. Yeah. So if you are, once again, an investor with cash and you're ready to, you don't know what to do with the money, I hate to sound different from other people, but like right now is probably a pretty good time to buy, to be honest, if you have the cash, if you have the cash.
Yes. Don't over leverage yourself. I mean, I don't want to bring it back to that, but there's a reason why that corner lot that you and I saw with a couple of different clients, like why there were 62 people seeing the place and why they got 19 offers. And it isn't just because it was priced well under assessment. It's also because it is a great potential redevelopment site with a lot mm-hmm. size being a corner lot and like everything like that. But I just really, I'm sorry. Like when you said the swimming pool in Richmond, I just immediately got distracted because I was thinking, what are you talking about? That new Minoru Aquatic Center, I walked by outside. It looks really nice. But then I realized you're talking about that failed development project. But, you know.
I bet you anything that swimming pool is bigger than whatever one that's in Minoru.
And a lot more expensive.
Yes, yes. And let's really hope that no more developer will have to get to that point. But I think a lot of developers, and that's, I guess this is what this article is saying, is that, you know, a lot of people, they do the math and they just, it doesn't make any sense. So they'd rather just, you know, put themselves on the sideline waiting for a better time.
And isn't that the whole point of what the government was doing with the interest rate hikes? They wanted to cool the market. So cooling the market doesn't mean it's great for people that are looking for places to buy or, but whatever. I'm not going to say anything else about the government because I really don't want us to get canceled.
Okay. 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 Let's not talk about the government. I'm done with this article. Anything you want to say before we move on to something a little bit more lighthearted?
Yeah. And I think like we've talked a lot about serious topics throughout the last 50 minutes or so. I want to end it on a little bit of a lighter note. And as you guys can see here, it says that the Canadian realtor hit with huge fine for drinking a customer's milk. And when they said huge fine, it definitely is a huge fine. I remember you and I last summer talking about this article and like it got shared on social media everywhere, Daily Hive, Urbanized, whatever. I'm sure our listeners have heard about this too. But we're not condoning this action. You have to admit that there is a little bit of humor when we are reading a headline like this at the realtor's expense, of course. I hope that person is okay because it sounds like they have a serious medical condition of dehydration. But I feel like in our industry, realtors often get a bad name because of the actions of a few. And this is a perfect example of that. You might remember last year in Kamloops, a seller saw on their surveillance camera that their listing agent opened their fridge and drank their milk straight out of the carton.
Oh, I think the article is wrong. It's the buying agent.
Oh.
So it's even worse.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I missed that point because I automatically assumed that it was a listing agent and I stopped reading. But as a buying agent, like, wow. Someone didn't take their ethics class. This takes make yourself at home to a whole new level. Basically, a year later, the realtor got fined $20,000. You heard right, $20,000 plus another $2,500 in enforcement expenses. Damn. I hope that milk was delicious. Must have been some of that Avalon shit or something, because Avalon chocolate milk is like on another level. But if the realtor doesn't pay, they might even have their license suspended. So,
oh my god, and I'll also add on to it, since we're on a lighter note now, anyways, I think in the article it says that the second time they went back, the seller asked the buyer agent right in front of the buyer about what happened, and he was like, oh, you're talking about the milk. And then literally the seller was like, get out of my house, I don't want to see you. And then the buyer fired that agent, hire another agent, bought that same house.
Oh my god. So not only do you lose $20,000 or $22,000, you're potentially out of a license, your reputation has gone down the drain, and you missed out on a deal.
Yeah, like I would like to assume that, you know, you've been trying to take this client out, you know, several times already before they settle on this one, right? And it is what it is. I mean,
all we can say is we hope it was worth it.
I hope that milk is worth it, because that $20,000, you might as well be drinking gold. but since we're on here, how many people forward this article to you and said, is this you?
I got at least 6 or 7, I feel like.
Okay. So it wasn't just me. I got so many people that messaged me. He was like, hey man, is this you? Because that's embarrassing.
But like, I don't even like milk. Like, I only drink chocolate milk on occasion, so I'll never be caught doing that. And come on, how hard is it to bring a water bottle in the heat of summer when you know there's a heat wave? This is common sense.
Two folds on that. Yes, I agree with you. Number one, let's talk about a little more lighthearted things, which is, why are you doing this? Please have some common sense. I know you're under a medical condition, but come on, drinking directly from the carton, not apologizing to the seller, give them a heads up, is not good. Okay, Jeff, let me put it in this way. If you were the seller and that buyer agent, really because of a medical condition, drank the carton of milk, told the listing agent, hey, can you please apologize, I'll buy a new milk, I'll deliver it right after this, can you please just tell the seller, like, you know, I drank out of their milk carton, I apologize, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why hasn't that happened, right? That's the first thing. And second thing, on the more serious note, is lockboxes. Let's quickly just talk about lockboxes here.
Mm-hmm.
I might be biased, I'm firmly a non-believer of lockboxes, because a lot of people say, oh, lockboxes are great, you know, the buyer's agent will have all the free reign to talk to the buyers in regards to, you know, the home, you know, without feeling awkward, without dealing with any of this stuff. Like, I get it. But on the flip side, when you don't have someone there representing the seller, situations like this might bound to happen. I have dealt with so many situations with heard, I don't do lockboxes, but I heard so many situations with lockboxes where the window wasn't closed, the key was lost, the main door wasn't locked, the alarm was tripped, the oven was turned on. Like, I have heard all of these stories. And I just feel like as an agent, when you have a listing, maybe putting on a lockbox this is just not a good idea. And on top of that, if you're not there, who's selling the home? Like, great, where I say the home will sell itself, blah, blah, blah. But it, why is there always salespeople at the presentation center? I guess let's just put it that way. If sales, home sells by itself, the presentation center should have no salespeople, just a bunch of AIs answering my questions, and I should still be able to receive the same result. But that's not the case.
You're living in 2050, bro. I'm just kidding. I mean, in all seriousness, I think you and I operate our businesses with a similar level of integrity. And like, I also agree that I don't think I will ever lockbox a listing. That's like my commitment to a seller, is that I will be there, or a colleague of mine will be there, because I'm not going to trust a stranger in my client's home and just give them free rein. That's just like asking for trouble. And this is, like you said, this is a perfect example of what could go wrong, and it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah. And I just think that by putting your seller's house in a lockbox, you're not really creating value as a real estate agent for the seller. That's all I'm going to say. And isn't our job for agency, like agency 101, is to look after our seller's best interests at all times? I would like to think that attendance is pretty important in regards to that. But then again, maybe I'm just overthinking it, because I understand that most of North America, they're generally all in lockboxes.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's true.
But it's just something that I still can't wrap my hands around. I feel like it does more harm than it does any good. Hey, but then again, I get it from a realtor perspective. If I have 12 listings, every single one of them is on lockboxes, I could probably still go to Kelowna and have fun with my family and stuff like that. Just go check it out yourself. I'll follow up with you on touch
base. So you're trying to say that realtors put lockboxes because selfish reasons?
Well,
I'm just kidding. Don't cancel. Okay.
Thanks for throwing me into the dish like that. Mm-hmm. But that's gave you a softer side and give you a more serious note on this more lighthearted conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Common sense ain't common. And with that, I think we will wrap up our July news roundup. And yeah, I do want to know from our listeners, though, like, what are some crazy stories that you guys have personally experienced or heard about in terms of real estate transaction showings? Like, it just makes a bit of an interesting topic, I think. And yeah, I really enjoy this past year working with you, Joe, and hopefully we will get 10 more years of podcast episodes to our listeners.
We are the real estate of Joe Rogan. What's up?
If our episodes start going like 2-3 hours long, I think I might have to tap out. I don't think we have time for that.
You're like, yo, I don't want to talk real estate for that long, man. Seriously.
Yes.
No, get it. But thank you for every listener that's been following us in the last 12 months. Hopefully the 34th episode is much better than all the ones before, because we are trying to be 1% better every single day in regards to it. Please, and we really mean it, we're an open book. If there's anything that you think we can do to better enhance your enjoyment of this podcast, please do let us know, and we're willing to try anything that's on the table, maybe aside from dancing in front of a camera for TikTok.
Joe might do it. I don't know if I would.
No, I'm not doing it. But with that being said, my name is Joe.
My name is Jeff. We are the Mike for Vancouver Real Estate. Thank you so much for your support. If you love us, please make sure you like, subscribe, comment, and share this with your best friends, family, and we hope to see you next week for a brand new episode.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
See ya.